Street at Today SOR.
Time now for our Friday gathering. The panel is with me in studio, but first a listen back to a flavour of the big stories of the past week.
I think we can both agree that we have much to discuss.
You and I officiated at the St. Patrick's Day parade procession in London. It was a pretty joyous occasion.
What we cannot do and will not do, and I know you understand this, is agree to the replacement of a legal guarantee with a promise.
Our governments have spent 3 years masticating this problem.
I think it's going to be a Herculean task for you, but we do want to be your friend and your ally, your Athena, in doing so.
Nearly 35 years in the making, Margaret Atwood's sequel to The Handmaid's Tale was launched last night. It's called The Testaments.
Instead of going away from Gilead, as we thought had been happening possibly in the 90s, we started going back towards Gilead.
Former English cricketer Geoffrey Boycott has said he couldn't give a toss about criticism over Theresa May awarding him a knighthood. The ex-England cricket captain was convicted of beating his girlfriend in France in 1998.
I don't care a toss about her, love. It's 25 years ago, so you can take your political nature and do whatever you want with it.
This is not difficult, it is not standard, and it represents an act of executive fiat.
The Commons is not so much divided, it's broken into jagged bits.
Phil Hogan is expected to be confirmed as the EU's next trade commissioner this morning.
He will be a very fair but determined negotiator.
You accused him of gambling with the peace process and described his cabinet as a hard Brexit dream team.
Well, all of that is true, I think, Sean.
Have you any thoughts on getting the US back to the table?
Well, it'll be a bit of ground hurling, I think, all right, Sean, as Mr. Trump has indicated his clear preference to have trade wars rather than trade agreements.
We have guaranteed Meat Industry Ireland that if they come back to us with adequate proposals, we will go to the farmers on the picket line to try and see an end to this.
We have seen a level of blockading and intimidation that has now resulted in a huge number of plants being closed down.
I'll have no work next week. I can't get beef out. The customers, how do you feed your family?
And that montage compiled by Tom Donnelly. With me now in studio, Darvel MacDonald, a journalist and commentator, Colette Brown, columnist with the Irish Independent, Colm Brophy, Fine Gael TD for Dublin South West, and Ivana Bacik, Labour Party Senator. Darvel MacDonald, I think you had the opportunity, I think, to tell Angela Merkel, of all people, about your concerns as somebody who grew up on the border, at the border, about what Brexit, and particularly a no-deal Brexit, would bring about. How are you reading things now? Do you see movement there or what?
Yeah, look, actually it's really interesting this year. I had an opportunity both to speak to Angela Merkel and to Nancy Pelosi and her delegation. And you might remember when we did that just a day later, Lara McKee was shot, you know, so a lot of the concerns we were bringing to that table and have the privilege to be doing so was about that. And I think, you know, the economic consequences of a no-deal Brexit have been well articulated. I think when you're looking at it from a Northern Ireland context, that confluence of the economic impact coupled with the fragility of things in Northern Ireland could have a very, very dangerous impact. Look, we've seen 8 separate standalone attacks against the PSNI since the beginning of the year. And they're not just attacks, they're near misses that could have resulted in significant fatalities. However, in the last couple of days, I wonder, and obviously the DUP are out denying the report in the Times this morning that there had been a shift. But I think one of the issues for unionists, many of whom might be open to the prospect of some sort of regulatory alignment, one of the key issues, and I see Bertie Ahern was addressing this earlier this week, is they're kind of saying, well, if there is alignment, you know, what sort of a say would we have in those circumstances? And this always, the big presumption is that the executive will be there and back up and running and not absent as it has been for the last 2.5 years. But, and then if the Northern Ireland executive were to have a say, what would that say amount to? Would it be tantamount to a veto or otherwise? So I can see some shift in the positions, even though the DUP is out publicly denying that any of its red lines have shifted. And I think that there is some scope there, but even earlier today, I think Leo Varadkar, just shortly before I came on air, I think speaking down Brian Apthorp thinking? He was saying that there was still some distance to go between the UK and the European position.
More than some, but one thing as well that he said to Gavin Jennings, Ivana Bacik on Morning Ireland earlier, was that he believes in the bona fides of Boris Johnson in wanting a deal. Do you?
Well, I was interested to hear that comment by the Taoiseach, because it is difficult to take Boris Johnson seriously on so many levels when he's come out with such appalling, appallingly ignorant statements about Ireland, about the border. And it was telling when he was here on Monday and asked repeatedly about whether he'd visited the border, and he didn't answer the question.
And I think
Kevin,
it was
Kevin Doyle from The Independent.
Yes, absolutely.
A very chilling, I thought, a very important question about, you know, all the people who had died in a ditch as a result of the Troubles, and he's making this flippant comment about dying in a ditch, and again he sidestepped. So it's hard to take him seriously. On the other hand, you know, it's so glaringly obvious to anyone, I think, who has any sort of objective sense of it, that a deal must be done to avoid economic catastrophe, not just on this island, particularly in Northern Ireland, but also for people in Britain. And I do think that, you know, what is heartening in the last few weeks in the awful mess of Brexit is the 21 Tory rebels who finally saw and were willing to take a stand, and indeed in many cases sacrifice their political careers. So I think we are, and John Bercow's intervention is also interesting, a speaker saying he will do all he can to ensure that Boris Johnson
Procedural
does not...
creativity, I think,
borrowing from Parnell, I think. So to return to your question, Boris Johnson has to be serious about achieving a deal. No, but, you know, otherwise, I think he will be the shortest-lived Prime Minister in British history.
Well, neither an 11-strong Supreme Court will be convening next week in London to hear
an audience. And that's the final point. That's the final point.
The Telegraph reporting today across the water that Boris Johnson is being urged by Cabinet allies to ask for a Brexit extension rather than disobey the law and risk a Jeremy Corbyn government.
Well, I think he's dug himself into a hole so much in that issue that it's hard to see how he's going to be able to avoid it, whether he's going to be hoping that the Supreme Court rules in his favour on Monday. The law has been passed now, and there seems to be that there's going to be a showdown when the deadline approaches. And you asked earlier whether you believe Varadkar really thought he was serious, or that Mr. Varadkar said today that he believed that he did want a deal. I mean, I don't think feasibly Mr. Varadkar could have said anything else. It's not like he could publicly come out and say that the British Prime Minister doesn't actually want a deal when there's supposed to be these negotiations ongoing for, you know, the next 6 weeks before there is a crash out disaster. But I mean, what judge a man by what he by what he does and not by what he says. But in relation to Mr. Johnson, you can judge him by what he does and what he says, and they're all equally bad in relation to Ireland
Colin
and our
Brophy,
position.
You were at the Fine Gael Think In for yesterday, and I think you heard as well from the former Taoiseach John Bruton, former European Union ambassador indeed to Washington. I'm just wondering, what was your sense there among colleagues and, you know, in the corridors about the prospects of a deal?
Well, I think I'll speak for myself. I think what I was listening to and what I took out of it is this. Yes, there is a long distance between the parties at this moment. But I think whatever way that Boris Johnson came to power and became Prime Minister, and whatever he had absolutely to the forefront of his mind in terms of maybe tipping into a quick election and going out without a deal, I think the reality of being Prime Minister and the reality of being in government has actually moved the dynamics of that. And I think there is a desire on both the British government side and on the EU side, which includes ourselves, to actually try and reach a deal. And I think that is very positive. I think everybody has really realised, in terms of the absolute starkness of the economic position for both our countries and for the EU in general, but particularly for both the United Kingdom and for Ireland, of what a no deal means. But what John Bruton, I think, spoke very elegantly on yesterday was, and the Taoiseach repeated those comments this morning, is the destructive element of that the entire process of the Good Friday Agreement and everything that's been done effectively since then is the idea of convergence, of bringing our countries and our peoples together and bringing the North and South together. Brexit is all about the destructive element of divergence.
And of consent.
And that, and the breaking of that. And that is why I do think that there are voices within the British government, that's why I think that comment you read earlier is important, who are beginning to realise that if an extension is what's needed, then that'll have to be done. And I'll just say one thing on this. I think that Boris Johnson as Prime Minister is probably, ironically, one of these people in the Trump-type mode who's better positioned to turn around at the 11th hour and said, I know I said that, but I'll still ask for the extension.
There's certainly no problem with U-turns, but I think, you know, insofar as a deal is possible, I know Phil Hogan this morning is saying a deal is possible even though there's such distance. The way it shapes up, it has to be along the lines of the Northern Ireland alignment that the Times, and the Times suggesting, of course, the DUP are moving towards that, however much they may deny it. But as Derval says, they would.
In the meantime,
that's the only way forward.
The pound has rallied somewhat this morning on that kind of, the markets are detecting a sentiment of a kind of a receding away from that no deal. But you're right, the whole principle of the Good Friday Agreement is consent, and I think that that has been lost, and it's very frustrating, you know, particularly sometimes when you're writing for the UK media, as I do from time to time, or trying to explain to others outside of Ireland just the sheer importance of it. And I think another thing that's maybe settling, maybe beginning to settle in the UK, is that even if it's a crash out no deal, it's not a standalone single event. At some point, the UK has to come back to trade, and that I think is maybe beginning to slowly to dawn.
Well, one of the points, in fact, that the Taoiseach made when he was welcoming Boris Johnson to government buildings on Monday. Colette, meanwhile though, Pascal Donoghue has said now he's planning his budget and preparing it and framing it on the basis of a no-deal Brexit. Is he right?
Of course he's right, yes, because he has to be cautious and he has to be prudent in relation to the budget, and he couldn't very well, I think, at this stage, with the chaos that's ongoing and the shambles that's ongoing in the UK at the moment, say that he credibly believes that there will be a deal, because, you know, he can't make that assumption and he can't make that presumption. And so in the interests of our own national interests and and to be prudent in relation to the national finances, he has to make an assumption that there will be no deal and plan for that eventuality, because it is going to be very serious for this country. It is going to have huge ramifications here for people living here, for people working here, for businesses, particularly in the border regions. And the government would be seriously degenerate almost if it weren't to plan for that scenario, I think.
Because the losses that we are facing in the event of a no-deal Brexit, and sometimes I think there's nearly like a Brexit fatigue. We've heard about the projected job losses, the impact on GDP, all of these things, but there's no escaping the reality that if we have a no-deal, and even if it's a harsh as opposed to a soft Brexit, we're going to be experiencing or expecting to experience, you know, systemic structural shocks to the economy across the island, in the UK, and Europe will not be immune from that either. And it's very, very interesting to see what was happening at the European Central Bank yesterday. So I think that it would be remiss for them not to plan for a no deal Brexit.
In Ireland, we believe the warnings. So our government has published what it believes will happen and the consequences of what a no deal would mean for our economy. The problem with Brexit is that in the UK, you have these zealots who have, you know, the lunatics have taken over control of the asylum. We saw the Yellowhammer documents being published. It doesn't seem to make any dent in the belief of these people.
It makes no difference, because I think what's fascinating when you talk to British people and British politicians now, and it's now not just, it's beyond politicians, it's to British people, is the normal rational way of looking at politics or looking at economics or looking at any type of political discourse is gone. This is a purely ideological issue. And when people in the UK, and it's the most divisive thing I think that's ever happened to their society and to their country, is what Brexit has
in
done
to us. In the meantime, Ivana Bacic, the Taoiseach saying very clearly, no election until May of next year. Is that something that's desirable in your view?
Well, again, I think he probably has to say that, and it's not a new message. He said that to Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin last year. He's made clear, I think, that next May is his desired date. It's a little bit like Pascal Donoghue preparing for no deal and the budget. They have to do that. I mean, I would be critical, and Labour would be critical, however, of failing to make provision for investment in public services in a budget. And I think that's an important
point. Could be bad for Labour, though. I mean, again, this morning he, as good as said, Fine Gael would do for Fianna Fáil what Fianna Fáil has done for Fine Gael if the numbers fall a certain way. Confidence and supply.
Well, it was an interesting comment.
That could sideline Labour.
To be honest, I think it could sideline both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on the basis that you now know that if you vote for either party, they're just going to be propping up the other. So that was what I certainly took from that rather surprising comment by the Taoiseach. So, you know, I think certainly as Labour, we'll be running in the election on a manifesto. We've got five key priorities around jobs, around housing, health, child equality, no child 2020.
You don't believe Labour should go into coalition, do you?
No. No, I don't, but that's not to say that I can't.
Well, how do you do anything if you don't believe?
Are you going to win an overall majority?
Can I just say this? Clearly, it would be a matter
question.
For, clearly, it would be a matter for the party membership, as that's in accordance with our rules in any case. But party leader Brendan Howland has made clear that our five priorities are there to ensure that there are red lines on the basis of which we would not support any government from opposition, indeed, or from within, unless those priorities were adopted. And the No Child 2020 list of priorities is crucial. And housing is particularly crucial because, let's not forget, if we have a no-deal Brexit and companies are looking to come to Ireland, or indeed even a managed Brexit, companies looking to invest in Ireland will be very clear. They want to ensure that their employees will have access to decent housing. That's a major problem currently for companies looking to invest here, is a lack
actually,
of housing provision.
And the government,
has been most remiss. We've still 10,000 people.
One of the things that we need to remember is that government have had an incredible successful record at foreign direct investment in over the last 3 years. We've actually, our economy has strengthened in so many ways over the last 7 years compared to where we were with the crash. It puts us in the position now to be able to do this cautious budget, and it is the right thing to do, to go back to Sean's original question, to have that very cautious,
stable
approach.
Yeah, but the question is, though, will the government last until May, Darvill McDonald?
I think it depends. I mean, if, you know, you do get a sense that the rubber is hitting the road on Brexit in terms of the forthcoming deadline, if that's extended out to January, arguably the public, because I think the public have bought into the notion that we have had a national government in all but name for the purposes of Brexit, whatever difference there might be in other policy areas. I don't know whether they would like to support that on a permanent, ongoing basis, but I think if there's an extension, the public may want that that kind of sense of solidarity. But yeah, I think you're right, if people just kind of think that voting for one or the other. But the only interesting thing is that when you looked actually, because you have to kind of look at what's happening at a grassroots level, when you looked actually what happened in the local elections, actually support for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael sort of solidified in some respects. So you have to kind of wonder, you know, kind of where the public would go for it. But I think that because we have such a visceral recall of the last crash, you know, when we saw so many of our people, young and maybe not so young, leaving, when we have that such a visceral memory of it, we do take those warnings seriously. And I think that Ireland would get kicked in the teeth if there was a no-deal Brexit.
The other thing I wanted to ask about was the intervention by the President, Michael D. Higgins. Colette Brown, maybe you first on this one, into the whole question of army pay, saying, look, you know, it's not too much to ask that they should be properly provided for.
I think it was, he was probably strained slightly into a policy area by making such a direct remark, a targeted remark about a particular segment of the public service. But then in relation to his role as president and both the Supreme Leader of the Defence Forces, I mean, he does have a special interest. One would be surprised if he wasn't advocating for
previous
the defence.
Previous presidents got slapped down for much, much, much less. And he's been interesting. I think that Michael D. Higgins, in part because of the extraordinary affection that voters have for him, I think has had much, much more liberty and freedom to comment on matters that previous presidents would have got slapped across the wrist for, certainly maybe told.
I think he was speaking in general.
Procedural creativity and getting away with observations that none of his predecessors
might have. People knew when they voted for the president in 2011 and when they re-voted him by huge popular claim just 7 years later. I think that people knew he's somebody who's always stood for decent pay, for a fair standard of living for everyone, for equality. And I think his comment, I think it was a fair comment. I don't think he made any political intervention. I think Donald Tajani has been very...
Did he not stray from his remit?
I don't believe he did. And as I say, I think the Tánaiste has said he doesn't see an issue with it. I don't think anyone in government is going to make any opposition.
To repeat something I said yesterday, quoting the late Albert Reynolds, you can't argue with 94%. Well, there's no point in a government taking on a president.
Well, Defence Forces pay is a very serious issue too.
From my perspective on this, and it's my personal perspective on it, I think that it was an unfortunate comment. And I think as someone who campaigned for his re-election and think he's an excellent president, I think that my worry is not the comment itself and not the content of the comment. My worry is, because having looked at the UK situation, how easy it is if you take away the parameters and the rules that exist in a constitutional setup.
Come on, Colin,
Sorry, just for a second.
For the future, for what happens when the next president does it, or the president after that, and where you say, and that's why I think those guidelines were put in place. So Is the comment itself? No, I don't think there's a huge problem with the comment itself. But I do think it was straying over that line a little bit.
We have
different rules for Michael Dee because we love him.
I'm not saying that, but
I think he's represented us impeccably well throughout his first term and into his second term.
But no one's arguing about that.
And I don't think anyone has any issue.
No one's arguing about that.
I would disagree. Great.
So no one's arguing about that.
But in that case, I think it's unfair to suggest that this is somehow the start of a slippery slope in some way, because he's a very careful and a very cautious president. He's been somebody who's been very careful not to step over convention. We might remember, way back, much more serious oversteps which were subsequently vindicated. I'm thinking of the Gerry Adams handshake. I'm looking at Derville, and I'm thinking of Mary Robinson as president. You know, things that were later vindicated were far more, one could have presented at the time, serious oversteps. I don't think President Michael D. Higgins has done anything of that nature. I think he's careful, he's cautious, and I think he represents us extremely well. And I think it was a fair comment.
Of course it was a fair comment. I don't think there's anybody in the country who doesn't support where so many members of our Defence Forces stand in respect to pay and their conditions. But I think, I'll put it no stronger than this, I think that because of the adulation, and as you say, that 94% the amount of people that adore him, I think he has the ability, when he chooses, to tiptoe across, to tiptoe across the constitution line with a greater confidence, perhaps, and than his predecessors.
And I think you're right, and it is because the affection which people, including myself, have for him. I always think, have to be that little bit cautious when it comes to these things.
Well, it's good to know we all hold him in such affection.
Another topic that dominated the headlines in the first half of the week, certainly, women's pensions up to a third lower than those of retired men, according to research from the Economic and Social Research Institute. Is that just a fact of life about which we can do nothing, given how men are more likely to be in the workforce for longer and have the benefit of private pensions?
Well, I don't think we should just accept it as a fact of life about which we can do nothing. I think probably nobody was surprised by the figures, given there's a gender pay gap, you know, when women enter the workforce, given the fact that women are much more likely to be low-paid workers, women are much more likely to be part-time workers, and this then obviously feeds down into their pension entitlements after they retire. I think, obviously, childcare and the caring role that women, most women, the majority of women would assume throughout their lives, also feeds into this. So, I mean, the government can do, and as a state we can do things to support women in the workforce. We can support women going back to work after they've had children. We can support women in their attempts to get better paid work, to get better terms and conditions in their work.
We can value the work that they do at home. Doing valuable work for society as a whole.
That's what the government is looking at doing. I mean, the government is developing a new national effective revision of the pension scheme, which will have an automatic enrollment element and will have, as part of that, what's being developed is an ability to take into account contribution for, obviously, in the area of work in the home, as people would see it, and the whole area of the fact that women.
That's unlikely to come in for a long, long time.
No, I don't think it is unlikely to come in for a long, long time. It's going to need a lot of the cross-party consensus we were talking on, because it's going to be the single type of biggest change. But the pension issue has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed in terms of closing that gender pay gap, and it has to be addressed
and
in terms of making
sure. One of the
suggestions
we heard from Orla O'Connor, head of the Women's Council, Ivana Bacic, during the week, was that the tax benefits to saving into a private pension scheme should be reduced. It should be just at the standard 20% rate. Now, that's not necessarily going to do anything other than have a bigger difference or a benefits gap between people who work in the public and the private sector.
Well, I thought the more interesting proposal from the National Women's Council was to give credit for work within the home in terms of pension entitlement. And I think that's something the government should be looking at very seriously and very urgently. And I would be critical of the government for failing to address this issue, both on the pension gender gap and the gender pay gap that persists for women in employment. They're failing to move. Without great urgency. I brought through a gender pay gap bill for Labour in the Shannon. It passed all stages in the Shannon and passed second stage in the Dáil. But rather than adopting that bill, which the government had initially indicated they would do, they brought in then their own bill. It's still slowly progressing through the Dáil. And as a result, we're not going to see companies obliged to publish gender pay gap data until, another year or so, I think, at the earliest. So there's no sense of urgency about addressing this now or for the future.
She sidesteps the question about the pension, the
Well, sorry, Sean. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good idea in itself, but it doesn't address the issue. The issue has to be addressed for women now who are subject to this huge discrepancy in their pension entitlement now. That should be addressed as a matter of urgency with the other proposal from the National Women's Council. But we also need to address the gender pay gap for women currently in employment so that they won't have a future gender pay gap when they retire in 10 or 20 years.
It might be an old-fashioned concept, but the Sunday roast, is it under threat with what's happening in the beef industry? The blockades and the lack of production?
I think the problem with the dispute is that it seems to be getting deeper, more intractable, more bitter as time goes on, and there seems to be nobody who can come in and get the two table or get the two parties to the table. I mean, it seems like mediation could be something that could be a huge benefit here, but it's hard to see how that's even going to happen when farmers are refusing to remove the blockades in order to start talks with the meat processing plants. They want retailers to come in, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of impartial person who can kind of organise all of these separate divergent, you know, parties and interests and get them around a table and get them negotiating, because that is going to happen or going to have to happen in order for this dispute to be resolved.
And I think it'll happen hopefully fairly soon, because the parties are beginning to realise, I think, on all sides at this stage, the only resolution is talking, and they have to, no matter how. And I think from the farmers' perspective, there's a lot of genuine grievances there, not just to what this immediately started about, but the whole way in which farming has been treated over many, many years by the beef processors, and the way there's an ingrained anger there within the farming community that has to be recognised. But the only resolution is...
Although it hasn't been picked up by your own party, which is quite a rural base.
I think it has, but what's happening now, and we've seen, is in a complete exacerbation of the situation, with a collapse in the actual price, and the fact that farmers are now really beginning to feel there is no future in this.
I think it's a bit of a perfect storm of long-held grievances. Yes. It's Brexit, it's Mercosur, it's all of the general uncertainty, and perhaps the activities of some of the farmers is maybe, you know, that kind of very extreme reactions are a product of that. But you have to look, well, what will the solutions be? Because, you know, EU competition law will not let allow a floor or a set prices, you know, kind of to be done. So I think, where is the leadership going to come on both sides to do that? And then how do you navigate a situation that doesn't go into something that looks or sounds like anti-competitive?
It could make for some lively times and maybe some tension at the ploughing next week if the talks don't get underway.
Well, the lack of leadership from the government is astounding, because while I think, as the others have said... Can I just finish the point? I mean, clearly this needs to be resolved. Obviously, as everyone has said, there's a number of issues that have been coming to a head for some time. So this is not a new issue. One has huge sympathy with the farmers, I think, because for far too long, as we've known, beef processing has been dominated by just a few players who are of major power, and that's really where the root of this. But we need to see resolution of this, because at a time we're approaching crisis on Brexit with all the implications for the agri-food sector, it's really not the time to have these sort of blockades. And I feel terrible. I think all of us have huge sympathy for the workers in the beef processing plants and we're seeing some supermarket chains already outsourcing to Britain for processing.
Leave it there.
That's
for
very
now.
Worrying.
My thanks to all of you: Ivana Bacik, Labour Party Senator; Colm Brophy, Fine Gael TD for Dublin South West; Colette Brown, columnist with the Irish Independent; and Darvel MacDonald, journalist and commentator.